For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicki. Valley Delegate Todd Gilbert gets a huge donation from the NRA, but statewide, the pro-gun group is getting outspent by gun control groups. Virginia is no longer home to a top 25 college as UVA drops to number 28 in one national ranking. And September Books and Brews author Heath Hartage Lee talks about how a group of military wives forced the U.S. government to focus on bringing POWs home during the Vietnam War. This is the WMRA Daily from Monday, September 9th. The National Rifle Association has donated almost $200,000 to Republican House Majority Leader Todd Gilbert, who represents Page and Shenandoah counties. But as Ben Pavier from VPM News reports, the NRA is being outspent statewide by gun control groups.
The donation is the largest check the NRA has cut in the General Assembly since at least 1996. Democrats say it's proof Republicans have been bought by the NRA. But Everytown for Gun Safety has pledged $2.5 million to its favorite candidates in this fall's elections. That's more than double what the NRA has spent in the last two decades. Gun control advocates say Republicans missed the chance to pass meaningful gun legislation at a July special session by delaying any votes until after the election. GOP lawmakers have argued that session was an election year stunt. A recent Roanoke College poll found voters ranked gun control as the fourth most important issue in this year's elections, after the economy, education, and health care.
That's Ben Pavier from VPM News reporting. Well, as first reported by the Roanoke Times, the White House appears to be pushing a Charlottesville-based prosecutor for an open seat on the federal bench ahead of two judges already vetted by bar associations and green-lighted by Virginia's U.S. senators. Also from VPM News, Haas Spencer has this report on the controversy.
University of Richmond law professor Carl Tobias says there's little to dislike about Thomas Cullen, who won hate crime convictions against four men, including the notorious killer of anti-racist activist Heather Heyer.
He's been very aggressive and so far very successful in prosecuting white nationalists.
Tobias says that Senators Tim Kaine and Mark Warner are upset that President Trump could be trying to bypass a Senate-based vetting process.
The easiest way to resolve this dispute is just to have Cullen come forward, go through the process, and then the senators will have to make a decision.
The Western District federal judgeship has been considered open since late 2017 when Judge Glenn Conrad went into semi-retirement.
In Charlottesville, Haas Spencer, WMRA News.
The Virginia Supreme Court has a new justice. The Richmond Times-Dispatch reports that Teresa Chafin, previously a judge on the Virginia Court of Appeals, formally joined the seven-member court Friday in a special session in Abingdon. The General Assembly elected her in February. Chafin is the sister of State Senator Ben Chafin from southwestern Virginia, who lobbied on her behalf but did not vote when the Senate confirmed her 36-0. Chafin will serve a 12-year term. She's filling a vacancy created by the retirement of Justice Elizabeth McClanahan. Well, Virginia is no longer home to a top 25 college, at least according to the latest U.S. News & World Report National University Rankings. The Daily Progress reports that the University of Virginia fell out of the top 25 to number 28. UVA came in at number 25 on each of the past 2 years' lists. Among public universities, though, UVA is ranked fourth in the nation, behind UC Berkeley, UCLA, and the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. Defense attorneys in Virginia are struggling to keep up with the amount of police body camera video they have to review. The Virginian Pilot reports that the wave of body camera adoption across the state has mostly happened without considering the thousands of hours of captured video that attorneys are ethically bound to review. The newspaper reports the workload is causing some public defenders' offices to lose attorneys faster than usual. Localities without public defenders' offices rely on court-appointed attorneys, leaving those attorneys to juggle their own practices and public defense cases. The workload also delays cases as attorneys request additional time to review videos. The newspaper says attorneys generally are not advocating for less body camera footage, but instead for more state funding to lighten the workload. Insurance companies and healthcare providers are engaged in a pitched lobbying effort in Washington and Richmond on surprise billing from Virginia Public Radio. Michael Pope reports.
Imagine you're out in rural Virginia and you have a medical emergency. you need to be airlifted to a hospital miles away. Eventually, you get a bill, an astronomical bill with an eye-popping number you can't afford. Jill Hankin, the Virginia Poverty Law Center, says patients need lawmakers to step in and provide protection.
When a consumer has insurance and they have an emergency or they go to an in-network provider, they should never get a balanced bill.
But when insurance companies and healthcare providers can't come to an agreement, patients get stuck holding the bill. One potential solution on the table in Washington and in Richmond would force some kind of arbitration. Another would use a regional average to come up with a bill. Clark Barineau at the Medical Society of Virginia says one approach he's concerned about would be benchmarking a dollar amount to an arbitrary number that would be the same in Bath County as it is in Arlington.
Rural providers already operate on such thin margins, it would eventually force providers to make some hard business decisions. And nobody wants that to happen because those are the people and the parts of the Commonwealth who need care the most.
This fall, the U.S. Senate is expected to debate a bill that would offer benchmarking as a potential solution for surprise billing. But Barineau says that could hit rural communities in Virginia hardest. I'm Michael Pope.
Finally today, during the Vietnam War, if you are a military spouse and your husband became a prisoner of war, you were not to discuss this with anyone except your immediate family. In the late 60s, a group of wives defied this policy by going public, ultimately forcing the U.S. government to take steps to bring POWs back home. WMRA's Matt Bingay spoke with author and historian Heath Hartage Lee about the untold story of the League of Wives.
This story starts on the West Coast of the United States in Coronado, California, which is known as sort of the birthplace of naval aviation. Sybil Stockdale is really the center of the story. She is married to Jim Stockdale, who is a fighter pilot. And Jim is shot down during the Vietnam Wars, and he's shot down in 1965, and he becomes a prisoner of war. Sybil, back on the West Coast in Coronado, is told by the government to keep quiet. She's not allowed to talk about her husband's prisoner of war situation with anyone except for her immediate family. Many, many people on the West Coast are in her situation, many military wives. Also those on the East Coast, like Jane Denton, who is Jeremiah Denton, another very famous prisoner of war. Jerry and Jane are based out of Virginia Beach on the East Coast. Jerry is also shot down and ends up in the Hanoi Hilton with Jim Stockdale. And soon, Jane Denton on the East Coast and Sybil Stockdale on the West Coast find each other and work with many other wives to form an advocacy group for these men and to really fight the government who's telling them all to keep quiet and not talk about their situation. And they eventually force the government to listen to them and to take some action.
Heath Hartage Lee, in the book The League of Wives, you touch on some of the tactics these wives used to influence and get the government to actually take action. Can you highlight a few of those tactics?
Oh, sure. Yeah, they had many, many very clever tactics. The first thing they all do, led by Sybil Stockdale, is to go public in the press. She's the first to go public in 1968. They don't start talking about the torture in the press until 69, but in 68, the dam is starting to break, and then it becomes a flood of other wives coming forward. Another tactic that they use very successfully, and they ally with Ross Perot, who's just died very recently, the eccentric Texas billionaire, to fly a lot of these women over to Europe to confront the North Vietnamese at their various consulates. And then the other thing they do from the beginning is to go to Washington all the time to walk the halls of Congress and basically stalk senators from their states and any politician from their state they can grab to inform them to support the women's activities. But they did a lot more than that in terms of brand awareness of the POW/MIA problem.
This kind of advocacy and challenging of authority that they lived under and even championed must have been quite a challenge for them and probably changed them quite a bit. Is that something that you encountered as you were looking at this story and talking to these women?
Oh, absolutely. You've hit on one of the major issues for these women right off the bat, which is they were very rule-based, rule-conscious, protocol-following conservative military wives. So to step out of line, to defy the military, to defy the government, knowing you could ruin your husband's career was super scary. They worried themselves sick about whether this was the right or the wrong call, but they all eventually decide that the benefits of going public outweigh keeping quiet, and indeed they turn out to save lives that way.
I'm curious how you found this story. I know it's out there, it's part of history, but it's not one I know well. So I'm curious, when did you uncover that there was a there, something to write about?
I like that. There was a there. That's exactly right. This is not a story I had ever heard of. I did not know about it. I found this in at Virginia, the Virginia Museum of History and Culture, and the staff there called my attention to some papers, the papers of Phyllis Eason Galanti, who was a Richmonder like I am. So they invited me to come look. And within 2 hours of looking at her papers, I was like, oh my God, this is an epic story about Vietnam that we've never heard of. I had never heard of any of these women. I did not know what the National League of Families that these women sound as the advocacy group. I'd never heard of it. And Phyllis's papers gave me almost a roadmap of who to talk to, how the movement started, her personal battle with that to bring her husband Paul back, who had been shot down in 1966.
Well, Heath Hartage Lee, author of The League of Wives, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
You are welcome. Thank you for having me.
Heath Hartage Lee will speak about her book, The League of Wives, this week at WMRA's Books and Brews. That's happening on Tuesday and Wednesday. You can learn more at WMRA.org, where you'll also find a longer version of this interview. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicki. Thanks for listening, and please support WMRA during our fall fund drive beginning today. Our goal is to raise $140,000 in less than 2 weeks. That means we have shortened the drive. We're giving you a week off. Stand with the facts and become a sustainer today at WMRA.org. Thank you, and enjoy your Monday.